Okay. All right. We're on the record. Do you need? Who needs lesson six? You do. Oh, hold on. Lesson six cannot be. And two, three. Okay, we're on the record. But is does he cut the audio? Does he check the audio, your son? Oh, okay. I'm sure she will. She's thorough. She's thorough. Lesson six. Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. This is now the official beginning of the class. And tonight is lesson seven in Messianic prophecies. And we're going to continue the book of Isaiah. And if I don't do this, it's not going to record. Like I said, I'm on jet lag, so it's... Okay, so let's start again. Tonight is lesson 7, Isaiah chapter 8 and Isaiah chapter 9, two different prophecies. And we are going to continue working on the book of Isaiah, probably, I would say, I suspect for the next 3 to 4 weeks, because we have this week 8 and 9, and then next week we'll do Isaiah 11 and 40. Then a week after that we're going to do Isaiah 42 and Isaiah 49, and then we'll get into Isaiah 53, and in and of itself Isaiah 53 probably will take us at least two sessions. So we're looking at the next, probably January and February, we'll probably be spending the entire time in the book of Isaiah, which shouldn't be surprising because it's one of the heaviest, of all the prophets of the Tanakh, of the Old Testament. It's definitely one that is very heavy on messianic prophecy. So we'll be spending a little more time in that book. And we started last time, before we stopped, we did Isaiah 7:14, talking about the virgin birth. And I think we did two, actually, didn't we? Didn't we? Isaiah 7:14 and Isaiah 11 also, or something? No, Isaiah 11 couldn't do because... No, that was it. Just Isaiah 7:14, never mind. Okay, so... and I brought some books that I wanted to show you tonight as well. So let's look at the first passage, the promise of Emmanuel, Isaiah 8, 9 through 10. The text reads like this: Then it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck, and the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. I put the bold is, of course, my bold in the text. Be broken, O peoples, and be shattered, and give ear. All remote places of the earth, gird yourself, and yet be shattered. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand, for God is with us. The reason this passage is in the class here, it's because we are in the few chapters that we're going to be studying here talk a lot about this Emmanuel, the word Emmanuel, and there's even a section of the book of Isaiah that is known as the book of Emmanuel. And we remember in chapter 7 that we did last time, God gave us I'm looking at the text, right, so you can follow with me if you want. God gave a short-term sign to King Ahaz through the prophet Isaiah's son Shear Yashuv, meaning a remnant shall return, as well as a long-term sign to the house of David through the birth of a child from a virgin, a child called Emmanuel. Emmanuel in Hebrew simply means God with us. Not even God is with us, just God with us. Following in the footsteps of chapter 7 of Isaiah, chapter 8 again makes mention of the name Emmanuel twice, and we just have him bold here. Now, it doesn't say Emmanuel exactly the same way both times, but those are the two times in the Hebrew text where you would see the word Emmanuel, Isaiah 8:8 and 8:10. In 8:10, the English translation does not do justice to the Hebrew grammar. The vast majority of English translations, to the possible exception of Young's literal translation, it doesn't mean it's my favorite version, it's just like it happens to be one of the translations, one of the few that actually renders it properly. The vast majority render Emmanuel as God with us. It is the proper meaning of the word, but to understand the passage better, it should be read, but it will not stand because of Emmanuel. Until the birth of Emmanuel, God has promised to preserve the line of David. So that's basically what we read in the text. So until that event takes place, no attempt, as bound to succeed as they may appear, will manage to destroy the house of David. Judah appears almost completely defeated in verse 1 through 8. In verses 9 and 10 do show an emphasis on the attempt to destroy. The result, though, is the protection of the Jewish people until Emmanuel comes, because God has not and will not forget his covenant with his chosen people. The event of the birth of Emmanuel took place, of course, at when Yeshua was born. He is the embodiment of you know, who Emmanuel is. A few decades later, in 70 AD, the temple was destroyed in Jerusalem, and with it, all the genealogical records of Israel. Today, it is no longer possible to identify any descendant of David. This verse reiterates the fact that Messiah, as a descendant of David, must be born before the records are destroyed. Thus, Messiah must be born before 70 AD. It doesn't seem to be a big deal, but the fact that Messiah needs to be born before 70 AD is a huge deal, because it disqualifies a lot of future false messiahs that have arrived on the scene in a Jewish community. There is another prophecy, for those of you who have taken the whole class, do you remember which one talks about that he would be from the line of Judah, which means that we have to be able to identify the Jewish Messiah to be from the line of Judah, thus from the tribe of Judah, thus we have to be able to know the family lineage, and that would have to also be before 70 AD when the temple was destroyed.
Genesis 49.
Get the verse. You're in the right chapter. Right book, right chapter. 49.
I don't know, somewhere between 12 and 17.
10.
Okay.
Genesis 49:10. Yeah. So that's those the other two. It's very important when you think about the Messiah. Right now, well, actually not right now. She just returned yesterday, today. She's returning to Paris today. When I was in Paris last week, my niece left for New York, and we had a chance to spend some time with the family. So I was there for 3 weeks, but. She was going to Brooklyn. She was going on a pilgrimage on the grave of Rabbi Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who died 12 years ago, who's supposed to be the quote-unquote Messiah. She, you know, my whole family is very, not my whole family, I should say, my niece, my two nieces and my nephew have gotten quite religious over the years, so she's the only one who's done it in the family, but she was going back to do a little bit of, you know, pilgrimage on Schneerson's graveside, and then a little bit of shopping in New York, of course, because you don't come from Paris all the way, not to do any shopping, but that's perfectly fine. But the point is, there are people today who go to the gravesite of Rabbi Schneerson, who himself never declared he was the Messiah. People made him to be, and of course, that was not all of the Lubavitcher section of the Jewish people, of the Orthodox Jewish people, but some said he was the Messiah. He never claimed himself he was, but to this day, people are still calling him with that title, and of course, he was not born in Bethlehem, he did not rise from the, you know, he was not born of a virgin, and on and on and on and on, but the mere fact that he was born after 70 AD, just like Shabbatai Zvi, who was a Messiah in Eastern Europe, I think, I forgot if it's in the 13 or 1600, but he was a false Messiah who actually eventually, under pressure, converted to Islam. Talk about a major turn of events here. Okay, a Jewish guy who claims to be the Messiah and then under pressure converts to Islam. Big disappointment. Yeah, his name is Shabbatai Zvi. I forgot the date, but he's in the notes in the notes. Yeah, of the first class. And then before that, of course, Bar Kokhba, the Jewish revolt under Bar Kokhba, and Bar Kokhba, Rabbi Akiva, who was who to this day is recognized as an authority in Judaism, called Bar Kokhba the Messiah, and of course he made a mistake. So, but he's still considered an important rabbi to this day. So we've had false messiahs over the centuries, and probably will continue to get some. And it might even you know, speed up as we get closer to the end. Yes, I saw a hand.
What do you think is the significance of three times in 8:9 he said, be shattered?
Well, the significance of a repeat is usually emphasis. Okay? So, you know, gird yourself, yet be shattered. Gird yourself, yet be, yeah. It's an emphasis of you know, in the passages, it's emphasis on the announcement that's being made. I mean, you'd have to look at the whole passage. But were you thinking it was something else, or?
No, I just thought it was for emphasis too. But
yeah,
you know, maybe to cause them to understand, you know, you can do what you will. But you're going to be shattered. I'm the one that has the control.
Right. Right. That's true. And it's, of course, it's you know, anytime you see something, there's another passage in, I think it's Zechariah 14, where it talks about the Egyptian celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles in the Millennial Kingdom, and during the Millennial Kingdom, and in like five or six verses, it says the Feast of Booth. Well, Tabernacles three times. It's repeated. You know, and usually it's, you know, when you see it more than once, it's usually because God wants to kind of drill it, you know, and it's like, this is important. And of course, human nature is usually the opposite. When we don't find it in the Bible, we love to speculate and build a new denomination based on that. So, but here it's probably most likely to overemphasize the importance of it. So this little prophecy is really this messianic prophecy here. The promise of Emmanuel is what it is. The promise of a coming Emmanuel, of God with us. Now, God with us, we saw, was introduced to us in Isaiah 7. God with us during the previous prophecy about the virgin birth. This one that will be born will be known as God with us. And it gets... it gets a little more precise in the next prophecy in Isaiah 9, 6, and 7. This is the I'm off by about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, because this is the prophecy that you usually find in the Christmas cards every year. So sorry for being off, but it's Isaiah 9, 6, and 7. Unto us a son is given. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. So, we have here, in the section as we continue, the book of Isaiah. This is known as the book of Emmanuel, chapters 7 through 12. This is a section of the book of Isaiah, as I told you prior. 7 through 12 is known as the book of Emmanuel within the book of Isaiah, because you read about this Emmanuel, this God with us, either by name or by concept, over and over and over. So it's painting this picture of God with us. And here, we've got a problem. Houston, we've got a problem. Here we've got a born human being who's supposed to be God, so to speak. So what are we going to do with that? Well, actually, a lot of people are trying to do a lot of different things with it, except to accept the fact that it's really what it is, both God-man. So we discover more information about the origin of the Messiah in those chapters. Here, both human and divine perspectives are mentioned in the same passage. This messianic prophecy has been a very controversial one, both in Jewish and evangelical circles, okay? So what I want to do is I want to break it down into different sections. First, we'll look at Messiah's human origins, Isaiah 9:6, first part of the verse, 9:6a. First part of the verse, Isaiah describes Messiah as a son given to us by God. This Messiah will be a male child being born into the human world, as we know from previous prophecies. Genesis 3:15, we've gone over those. Genesis 3:15, 22:18, and 49:10, all those three prophecies in the first book of the Bible. He will be born in the human realm, but specifically from the Jewish descent. Actually, those prophecies are listed, those verses listed in the next page. Genesis 3:15, I will put enmity between you and the woman. And that's top of page 3 now. And between your seed and her seed, he shall bruise you on the head, you shall bruise him on the heel. Genesis 22:18, and in your seed all nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. And Genesis 49:10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Those are the three previous prophecies that we've discussed, we've studied, that describe this born one that's going to be born, this Emmanuel, that will be from the human descent. It will be of Jewish descent, and it will be from the tribe of Judah. That's just to summarize those prophecies here. The son described in Isaiah 9 is the same as the one in Psalm 2. We'll discuss Psalm 2 later in our study, probably in about 10 years at the rate we're going, but maybe nine years if we're lucky. On one hand, the human aspect of the child slash son of Isaiah 9, 6, and 7 is seldom, if ever, put into question. His divine aspect, on the other hand, is a different story. So nobody ever argues that he's going to be born human, because it's in the text. But people argue that he's going to also be God, because it's in the text. See, that's the problem. They're both in the text, and it's impossible to reconcile. Okay, I've told you the story before. You remember the Hebrew class I took in Seattle years ago. I'll tell you again in a nutshell. I took a Hebrew class, and I had my Bible. I was taking conversational Hebrew, and the professor was very good, fluent in Hebrew. And I forget if he was from Israel or not, but he was really good. And then after a few weeks, I told him, I said, I want you to know, I'm Jewish. I believe that Jesus is the Messiah. He died for my sins. I give my life to him. So many years ago, I don't know when it was, but I'm not going to bother you with that. I just want to learn Hebrew. But if you have any questions, feel free to ask. And the guy said, business is business. So we take the class, and one day I say, I have a question for you. Could you read me Isaiah 9, 6, and 7 in Hebrew and give me a translation? And so he wanted me to do it from, my Bible. I said, no, I want you to read it from your Bible, not mine. So he grabbed his Bible, and then he looked, and he starts reading, under his beard. Reads again, and he goes, "You're good. You guys are good." And I go, like, good? We who and what? Good for what? And he said, because it's impossible. And I said, what is impossible? Of course, I was a little devious because I knew where he was going, but I wanted him to kind of wrestle with the whole thing and then go home and go like, what do I do with it now? You plant a seed and then you let them, struggle with it and either ask other questions or kick you out. In this case, it was, plan B. We didn't go back to the class after that. Just a few weeks and then we didn't continue. But in there, he read that basically, he told me, he said, there is a description of that child that will be born that only applies to God. So it cannot be applied to a human being. I said, well, so what is it supposed to say? He said, well, it's just, and I asked him to read it in Hebrew because in a moment I'm going to show you what people do with the English. And it's very devious. It's got a big agenda here. So let's go back to the text now. The human aspect is never argued, never discussed. It's so everybody agrees on the first part of 9:6a. 9:6b describes the divine aspect of this person, and that's where some issues are brought up. We get into the section where the son is given four names, each having two parts. Each of these names is applicable to God, three of them exclusively to God. Unfortunately, the Hebrew grammar has been altered by many, voluntarily or not. And as a result, the divine attributes of this human child are either gone or hard to find in the text. So a closer look at the four names is necessary. The first one, a wonderful counselor, or in the Hebrew, Pele Yoetz. Pele can be found in all those verses, Exodus, and they're on the next page, actually. We'll read them real quickly. From Exodus, Psalm, Isaiah, Lamentation, Daniel. Strong's number 6382, Pele, in definition, means wonder, marvel, wonder, extraordinary, hard to understand thing, wonder of God's acts, judgment, and redemption. And it's really the word Pele only applies to God. Look at the verses on page 4. Who is like thee, and then I'm reading from, the Exodus 15:11. Who is like thee among the gods, O Lord? Who is like thee, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? That's the word Pele right there, or a variation of the word Pele. Psalm 77:11, I shall remember the deeds of the Lord. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. Psalm 77:14. Thou art the God who workest wonders, that hast made known thy strength among the peoples. Psalm 78:12. He wrought wonders before their fathers in the land of Egypt in the field of Zoan. Psalm 88:10. Wilt thou perform wonders for the dead? Will the departed spirit rise and praise thee? Psalm 88:12. Will thy wonders be made known in the darkness, and thy righteousness in the land of the forgetfulness? Psalm 89:5. And the heavens will praise thy wonders, O Lord, thy faithfulness also in the assembly of the holy ones. Psalm 119:129. Thy testimonies are wonderful, therefore my soul observes them. Isaiah 25:1, which is further down in the book of Isaiah. O Lord, thou art my God, I will exalt thee. I will give thanks to thy name, for thou hast worked wonders. Plans formed long ago with perfect faithfulness. Isaiah 28:29. This also comes from the Lord of hosts, who has made his counsel wonderful and his wisdom great. The two words peleioetz, top of page 5 now, the two words peleioetz are often separated by a comma, making them two separate words when in fact the Hebrew does not call for it. Commas don't exist in Hebrew. The word wonderful is in the construct and should not be separated from counselor. There are words in the Hebrew that are to be used exclusively of God, such as the word bara in Genesis 1:1, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning God, or created God really in the Hebrew, but in the beginning God created. The word bara means to create, means God created, and it's created in the sense of created, and we don't create, God creates, okay? We say, well, I created this piece, I created this cake, this painting, but God is the only one able to create from nothing, create. So the word bara is, in the Hebrew, means to create, and it's only used when God creates. It's on page 5. You probably have the wrong notes.
Yes,
because
we do. We don't have any of that stuff.
Okay, well, you know what? Did you get those from tonight?
Uh-huh.
Who didn't get those?
We all have them.
Except for, no, tonight. Tonight. Okay, I think you're, oh my goodness, I think you know what I gave you? I gave you the old
version.
I apologize.
Oh.
You might have, I had two sets of notes, and let me see.
So we need the updated version.
Okay, this is the updated version. My apologies.
Oh, thank you.
I always change my mind, and I don't even know. I'm sorry. So you've got the old set of notes, so dump them. And you don't even have page
3.
Okay, page 5. Well, there you go. All right, for those of you watching on the internet, just go to the fridge and get a snack. And that's it. Okay.
And I have a question.
Yes.
Okay, is, for example, peleioetz.
Uh-huh.
Is there a hyphen in between or not?
No. As a matter of fact,
because I read somewhere it was by an anti-missionary, and they were making a case, and I forget which was whether it was for or against, but they were saying it couldn't be. Obviously, whatever they were saying was opposite of what it's supposed to be, and I couldn't remember.
Well, there's a couple of ways. Let me read the rest of page 5 now that we all have page 5 in our notes. I'm so sorry. You look so lost. I'm going like, is it me? They're usually not that lost. Well, you didn't have the notes. Okay, so top of page 5, the two words peleioetz are often separated by a comma, making them two separate words when in fact the Hebrew does not call for it, either a comma or a hyphen in the English. They're words in Hebrew, like I told you, bara, meaning to create, that are only used when God creates, as in Genesis 1:1. Pele, meaning wonderful, is one of these words only applicable to God. Additionally, the same two words can be found, did you have all the scriptures that I read you before? Did you have those? Okay. It can be found in 28:29, Isaiah 28:29, the last one on the page 4. This also comes from the Lord of hosts, who has made his counsel wonderful and his wisdom great. Right there, the two words are found only of God in that context. And nobody's arguing it in that verse, which is only 28, only what, about 19 chapters after Isaiah 9. But that one in Isaiah 9:6 is an issue. Now, several rabbis, famous Spanish rabbi Abraham ibn Ezra, say there are some interpreters who say that wonderful, everlasting Father are names of God and only Prince of Peace is the name of the child. But according to my view, the interpretation is right, which says all are the name of the child. So that must have been a really troubling statement that he made in the 1100s, because that definitely would go against the flow. I'm not saying that Ibn Ezra was a Jewish believer in Yeshua. I really don't think he was. But occasionally a rabbi would make a statement that would defy Jewish tradition, and it would remain in the Jewish writings. And that's part of the Talmud, you know, the commentaries on the Jewish law, is that you have a rabbi that will say, like Ibn Ezra, and according to Abraham Ibn Ezra, and they quote him, and immediately after that it says, but Rabbi Shlomo ben something says that really it means that, and Rabbi Eliezer ben something else really says that Rabbi Shlomo is almost right, except that he wants to add this and delete that, and then you got another 5 page, 50 page, 500 page. So this is what the Talmud is notorious for. You have one thought, and then people don't want to. You know, nobody really wants to denigrate the person, you know, point blank, like, well, this guy is a heretic. But they want to say, like, well, what he meant, you know, Jewish, you know, maybe what he meant is this, and we should add this and look from this perspective and add that. And by the time you done reading a few pages of maybe, you forgot the original thought. So, but what's more troubling to me is the last part of page 5. Many Jewish commentary do not give an explanation for Peleioetz, while they cover the other three names. Additionally, various Jewish translations of the passage simply transliterate the verse when they come to it. For instance, the Jerusalem Bible, which is the one I'm holding in my hands, current publishers, Jerusalem. Or even worse, add words to the text. I'm going to read them to you both. This is the Jerusalem Bible. This is a very common Jewish Bible used in synagogue, used by Jewish people. Not to be confused with the Jerusalem Bible, which is also a title of the Catholic Bible. That is not what I'm talking about here, okay? This is a Bible that has Hebrew on one page and English on the other page, and they're matching. So it's, you know, each page corresponds to each side in English and in Hebrew. And so the purpose of this is to have a translation in English so you understand. For those of us who don't read Hebrew fluently, you have the Hebrew here, and then you look at the English, and it's got the verse numbers on both sides. Very interesting what they did with that passage. You have the English, and then all of a sudden, when it comes to the forewords, the translator was unable to translate. He forgot his English. So what he did a transliteration of the Hebrew word in English letters. So I'm going to read to you what it says in English exactly the way it's printed. And you can look at it after class if you want. We need to keep going, so I'm not going to... We'll pass the books later, but here it says, and I'm reading the verse of Isaiah 9, 6, and 7. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government is upon his shoulder. So far, so good. And his name is called, and then he must be drawn a blank. And his name is called Pele Yoetz El Gibor Aviav Sar Shalom, for the increase of the realm and the peace without end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth forever. So we have English, and all of a sudden transliteration, which is a phonetic writing of a word in another language that, you know, you just, if you read it in English phonetically, it will sound like you're reading that other language. It's what we know as transliteration. And here it says, Pele Yoetz El Gibor Aviav Sar Shalom. Couldn't figure out all of a sudden. And then we go back to English, just for those four words. Just for those four words. And the whole Tanakh. That's just, it's just disappointing to me. It's more. Yeah, that's Pele Yoetz, the word Pele. He said it cannot be used for anything but God. Yet he saw that it was used for a human, so it was like he was troubled.
Well, may I ask, wouldn't it have more impact with the transliteration than with the English? Because in the English, unless you know what you're explaining right now, you would just think of it as how we read it, but they wouldn't realize it's applied to God only.
Well, it would have more impact, except that most of the time in the side, in the end notes, it says meaning uncertain.
Right.
And then all of a sudden the meaning is certain 20 chapters later when Pele and Yoetz are put together, maybe in a slightly different form in the Hebrew construct, but meaning the same thing. So there is an agenda. I'm telling you, there is an agenda. The agenda is to prove that passage cannot talk about man and God being in the same person. Now remember, when I have to stop say recently because it's at least 3 years ago. So, but I had a Jewish lady coming to our Bible study, and that was the number one issue she had. She was an unbelieving Jewish lady, very very curious, and she kept coming and asking questions. And we actually were doing that study. It was more than that now, because it was probably more like 5 or 6 years ago. My goodness. Time flies. repeatedly, probably at least half a dozen times, she would always get stuck, and she said, I just cannot believe, as a Jew, that man can become God. And I kept telling her, but neither can I. I never did. God became a man so he could die for our sins. He lowered himself to become a man, emptied himself of his divine attributes, but he never died. God never died. In his humanity, he died to pay for our sins. And it took me several times telling her, another gentleman at the Bible study who was also teaching, had several chances of telling her the same thing, and eventually one day she finally, you know, again, the divine appointment, finally she said, ah, this makes sense. Same story. It made sense that day, and she prayed to receive the Lord. So, but that's the biggie. That's the biggie. Jewish people don't like the God-man thing, you know. And of course, when we say it's 100% God and 100% man, not 50-50, then we're really pushing the envelope even further.
Do you recommend staying away from this verse for witnessing?
No! No, it's one of the. It's one of my favorite ones.
Okay.
Oh, no, I mean,
it's, because it's
you know,
going to cause them
you know,
to struggle.
Stay away from topics like the Holocaust. Stay away from that. I mean, at all costs, okay? Because there's really no way to handle it properly. Okay, God is in control. God is all loving, all powerful. Why the Holocaust? I don't know. Okay, it's a big one. Okay, so stay away from that unless they corner you into it. Then handle it the best you can. But something like this, I would say no. I say, hey, what do you make of that? Now, most people you're going to talk to, I would say 80 to 90% of the Jewish people you're going to talk to, they don't even know who Isaiah is. They're going to go like, Pele what? But if you talk to somebody who's learned and who's got a little bit of understanding of the Bible, they'll look at that and they'll go like, I promise you that Hebrew teacher that night went home and went, it was troubling. He was not happy about it. I don't know where he is now, but made him think. No, I would not stay away from that. I mean, I would use it as a tool, definitely. This one is interesting. This one is the JPS. It's even more popular than this one, Jewish Publication Society. This is, I believe, definitely the newer version, but I don't know what the last one, I think, was 1915. This is 1985, and the one they did before that was 1915, and it was different even before that. But this one has, let's see, 9-6. Now, by the way, in a Jewish Bible, sometimes, and this is not heresy, this is not a mistake, sometimes because the way the scrolls were put together as opposed to the way the books are put in the Bible, you might be off by one verse. So Isaiah 9-6 might be Isaiah, like right here it's Isaiah 9-5, not 9-6. It's not a mistake, it's because there's one, you're one off on the numbering, but remember originally in the original documents there was no numbering. Here it says, for a child, now this version takes a different slant. Instead of just not remembering what to say about those words, it just embellishes them and makes them say something completely different, yet far from the meaning of the Hebrew. Here it says, for a child has been born to us, a son has been given us, and authority has settled on his shoulders. So far, so good, right? He has been named, and then here is his name. The mighty God is planning grace. There's no is anywhere in the Bible. It's not a sentence. There are four groups of two words. Four descriptive, okay? So he has been named. The mighty God is planning grace. The eternal Father, a peaceable ruler. And then it goes back and goes back to the real meaning of the text. In token of abundant authority and of peace without limit upon David's throne and kingdom, that it may be firmly established in justice and in equity now and forevermore. Just like the other one, just like what the Hebrew says. But here, it's uncomfortable. You know, we don't want to deal with it, so what can we do to change it? Rashi French rabbi of the 11th century, changed a lot of those, the meaning of those messianic prophecies. And as a matter of fact, I think I have something about Rashi in the next couple of pages. Let's keep moving here. B, on top of page 6. Are you with me on page 6 here? I just got to double check. good. Okay. Mighty God, El Gibor in Hebrew, Deuteronomy 10:17, Psalm 24, Jeremiah 32, Nehemiah, and Isaiah. Deuteronomy 10:17, for the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who does not show partiality nor take a bribe. Psalm 24:8. Who is the King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Twice in that same verse. Jeremiah 32:18. Who shows loving kindness to thousands but repays the iniquity of fathers into the bosom of their children after them? O great and mighty God, the Lord of hosts is his name. Nehemiah 9:32. Now therefore, our God, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God, who keeps covenant in loving kindness, do not let all the hardship seeming insignificant before you, which has come upon us, our kings, our princes, our priests, our prophets, our fathers, and on all your people from the days of the king of Assyria to this day. In Isaiah 10:21, a remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. All those variations of the word El Gibor, if not exactly the words El Gibor. Mm-hmm. This description can obviously never be used to describe a mere mortal. No human in the Bible was ever called God, except, of course, for this instance here in Isaiah 9:6. So except for the God-man himself, Yeshua the Messiah. Many Jewish scholars, as well as liberal Christian theologians, object to the idea of Messiah as the God-man. In order to justify their interpretations, they have to alter the text and add or delete, I should say, words not in the original Hebrew. Most of the time, add words, actually. Even though it is wrong, we have come to expect this deviation from the original meaning when it comes from non-believing rabbis, such as the French Rabbi Kimchi or Rabbi Rashi, as they all had an agenda. We've come to believe that, to expect that, because, again, especially in the case of Rashi lived at a time of history where the Jewish people were being decimated, the Jewish race was being destroyed, and he was afraid that Jews were going to disappear and all convert to Christianity. Remember that in the Jewish mindset, identity equals survival. Identity means survival. If you keep your identity, you'll survive. If you lose your identity, you will eventually completely disappear. And in a Jewish mindset, when you become a Christian, you lose your Jewish identity. If you lose your Jewish identity, you eventually cease to exist, and then the Jewish people will completely disappear from the planet. That's the Jewish mindset. It's just like it's the Jewish worldview, so to speak. So, of course, a Jew who believes in Jesus, or a Jew who becomes a Christian or a believer or a Hebrew Christian, a Messianic Jew, whatever you want to call them or me for that matter, does not lose his Jewish identity. He chooses to express it and do with it what he wishes. But I never lost my Jewish identity when I became a believer 30 years ago. If anything else, I enhanced it. I found my Jewish identity in the Jewish Messiah. And my blood is still Jewish blood in my vein, through my veins, so I did not have a dialysis when I became a believer. Rashi completely avoids the subject by applying the text to Hezekiah, as we can read in his commentary. Now, the text in italics here is not biblical text. It's just Rashi's commentary, which, by the way, you can find. I give you the reference on the bottom of the page here. It's on the Chabad webpage under Rashi's commentary of the entire Old Testament. It's quite well done, very easy to follow and check verses. A little overwhelming at times, but the important part is that very often Rashi is a great rabbi. I mean, he's got a lot of wisdom, a lot of great things to say. But when it comes to defend the Jewish people from Yeshua and protect them from turning to Yeshua, he was very creative. Sometimes he tried hard. Sometimes he didn't even try hard. And in this case, I think he didn't really try hard. Isaiah 9:5, for a child has been born to us, a son given to us, and the authority is upon his shoulder, and the wondrous advisor, the mighty God, the everlasting Father, called his name the Prince of Peace. It's not even exactly the text the way it is in Hebrew to start with. For a child has been born to us, and that's Rashi's commentary, although Ahaz is wicked, and that's referring, going back to Isaiah 7 now, where King Ahaz was messing with Isaiah when he was telling Isaiah, I don't want to tempt God. You know, when Isaiah said, pick a sign, any sign, from the heaven to the bottom of the earth, pick a sign and then God will give me a sign to show you. And he said, no, I don't want to mess with God, when really what he, you know, he didn't believe that for a second. So Ahaz was quite wicked. So he is, Rashi is right on that. Although Ahaz is wicked, his son, who was born to him many years ago, 9 years prior to his assuming the throne, to be our king in his stead, shall be a righteous man in the authority of the Holy One, blessed be he, and his yoke shall be on his shoulder. For he shall engage in the Torah and observe the commandments, and he shall bend his shoulder to bear the burden of the Holy One, blessed be he, and called his name the Holy One, blessed be he, who gives wondrous counsel, is a mighty God and everlasting Father, called Ezekiah's name the Prince of Peace, since peace and truth will be in his days. So Rashi is saying, like, this, those four groups of, he doesn't even say those four groups of, this description of this Holy One who's going to come, this that's going to have godly attributes, really is direct reference to Ahaz's son Hezekiah, who would be a very, and of course he's talking, he's looking back, because Hezekiah was born many years before Rashi. You know, we're looking back after Rashi. But in the days of Rashi, he said, this is describing Hezekiah, who's going to be studying the Torah. He's going to be blessed by God. And so that's, and people just say, okay, that's good. That's good for me. Good for me. But never, ever does he even admit that that does not just, that cannot be used for men. While earlier, Rabbi, what's his name, Ibn Ezra, said that they all these words describe a human being, and there was a struggle there. There was something, you know, he could not reconcile the two. At least he was being honest. Not coming up with an answer, but being honest. Okay, and that's really what happened in a lot of cases with a lot of rabbis up to Rashi in the middle of the 11th century, where they all went like, well, this is the text. This is what it says. Don't ask me what it really means, because I'm not sure. But this is what it says. Now, I can't give you, like, in a case like this, it would say, like, well, it seems to be describing a man, but it seems to be describing God. I don't know if that's possible, but that's what the text says, and there's no mistake in the text. It's been copied by scribes over, you know, from one generation to the next. And then it went one step further. It said, well, because it cannot be, because in our world, in our finite world, with our set of agendas to protect whatever community we have that we want to protect, because it cannot say what it says, we have to make it say something else. So then the interpretation starts flowing, and then creativity takes over, and you get things like this. So it's frustrating. It's very frustrating. And of course, this is something that most Jewish people, again, 85, 90% of the Jewish people don't even know about this, because they don't read their Bible. Many Christians, to be honest with you. So they take the rabbis, or Rashi to this day is the authority. I mean, we have the Ryrie Bible. They have the Rashi Bible. Seriously. They've got the Bible, you know, the Tanakh, the Old Testament, with the Rashi commentary in it. And most Jewish people who study Scripture will not even get near the Word of God without Rashi. It's almost like a security blanket. It's like, well, what is Rashi saying? You know, I can't really be negative too much about that one, because there are Christians that will not read their Bible unless they can see what Charles Ryrie says in the notes. Like, well, I can't try to figure this out on my own and do a cross-reference, or, God forbid, a Bible study. That would be too much work. I got to get the answer right away, and I got to take it from somebody who knows, and I'm done. So it's not just the Jewish people. It's human nature. We have to be careful when we look at that. So where was I? Yeah. So what I was saying is that we... I want to reread this because, yeah. So we have come to expect this deviation from the original meaning when it comes to non-believing people or rabbis like Rabbi Kimshi or Rabbi Rashi. It in bottom of page 7, it is more of a disgrace when it comes from Christian theologians and creeps into the text of contemporary Bible, versions such as the New English Bible. The New English Bible adds more words to 9:6 to read, "In battle he will be godlike," but immediately after translate the same words as "mighty God" in chapter 10, verse 21. So the integrity and consistency of the translation is obviously lost. People would not, most people don't speak Hebrew or Greek, so they just kind of go with the flow and it sounds good and, you know. Next is Eternal Father, page 8, Avi Av, or Avi Ad. It's really Avi Av, really. Literally, this means Father of Eternity. Many have been confused by this description as they think that it describes the Son as the Father in the context of the Trinity. And let's look at the Trinity diagram that I have on page, what?
Last.
On page last, okay? And so we have, I should probably do it on the board because it's being, it's a good, let me go get the pen real quick. Because it's, you have it in your notes, but for the benefit of everybody, we have the this little diagram here. Now we have God here. Oh, great. Okay. We don't have anything yet. Okay, so let's see. Oh, good. I hope it's dry erase and not... okay, good. So we have God. And then we have... so we can put Father, Son, and Spirit. And here you have is not. The Son is not the Spirit. The Spirit is not the Son. The Son is not the Father, and the Father is not the Son. The Father is not the Spirit, and the Spirit is not so. The Son is its own, Father is his own, Spirit is his own. Yet, the Spirit is God, the Son is God, and the Father is God. And before you ask me, no, I did not come up with it, okay? But I thought it was very clear, and so I stole it. I believe originally it was in the book by Charles Ryrie, not to mention him twice in the same lesson. So, but this is, now does this mean that now we know all about the Trinity?
No.
No, absolutely not. It simply means that there is a dynamics here in the Godhead that if you don't look at it this way, you come up with all kinds of things where the, you know, all three and the three are the same, or one becomes one and then becomes the other and then and vice versa and changes at will. No, the Godhead, it should be really the Godhead here. Even more precise, the Godhead, you know, the Son is part of the Godhead, you know, so you have all those things like this. It's it is and is not, and it tells us it's a very unique dynamic that we don't find anywhere else. How is that possible? The answer is yes. Not for tonight. But there's plenty, this being said, there are plenty of scriptures, and maybe... If I get to finish that class and I'm still around before we make the big move, I have a series of lessons on the duality, the plurality, and the Trinity of the Godhead with all the scriptures that we can find in the Old Testament, not even the New Testament, because we get it from the New Testament. It's how you know Jesus and the Holy Spirit and God, and you know, like you see him in some places where when the dove comes from the sky and this is my beloved Son, you know, God speaking and the Holy Spirit in the form of a dove, and then you have Yeshua, Jesus being baptized. You see it all happening in front of your eyes, so to speak, in New Covenant. But in the Old Testament, there are scriptures, even in Isaiah, I think it was Isaiah 48, where you actually read about the three. It's really cool. So maybe one day we'll get to do that one, or maybe I'll take a break and, you know, in between, and we'll do it. But it's a cool study. So the Son clearly is not the Father, but everlasting Father is an idiom used to describe Messiah's relationship to time, not to other members of the Trinity. The last one is the Prince of Peace, Sar Shalom. Of the four titles, this is the one, the only one, that can be used interchangeably for either man or God, depending on the context. In the context of the book of Isaiah, as seen in Isaiah 26:3 and 26:12, it refers exclusively to a peace coming only from God. But again, it could be either or. Isaiah 26:3, the steadfast of mind you will keep in perfect peace because he trusts in you. Of course, perfect peace can only come from God. Isaiah 26:12, Lord, you will establish peace for us since you have also performed for us all our works. So only God can bring perfect peace. Only God can establish a peace for mankind. This reference about peace in Isaiah 9:6 is the first of 25 references about peace found in Isaiah, in the book of Isaiah alone. Read in the broad context of the book of Isaiah and the closer context of the book of Emmanuel, again Isaiah chapters 7 through 12, this description of the child is clearly an attempt to explain to the reader the uniqueness of this child who will be both God and man. Only Messiah Yeshua fulfilled that prophecy. And it will be both God and man, not 50-50, not 60-40, but 100-100. And how is that possible? Again, the answer is yes. We don't know. That's, you know, there's some things that we take in faith, but when you study the character of God in the Bible, it all seems to indicate that he's fully human and fully divine. And I always say the same thing. One day we'll be in a place when we can ask all these questions. And fortunately, when we're in that place, we really won't care. We won't ask the questions because we'll be in his presence. It will be like, I don't care. I mean, why would I bother now? I wish we could ask and get explained, but we know what we know, and we have to be patient that one day we'll be in his presence, and that'll be enough. So, but if you're like me, I'm impatient, and I want to know. The last part of the passage is verse 7, the last verse, the rule of the king. In the last verse, the God-man is now described as a king who will sit upon David's throne eternally. This verse in itself is a reaffirmation of the Davidic covenant that we can find in 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 14, when God promised David four things. We have that passage on the top of page 9, 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 14. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendants after you, you who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. In that short passage, we see four things. An eternal house or dynasty will be established, an eternal kingdom, an eternal throne, an eternal son. In this verse, it is confirmed that David's house, kingdom, and throne will be maintained forever by this everlasting son. Of course, that can only be accomplished by Yeshua the Messiah. And it hasn't, it's a promise, but it's not quite there yet. So from Isaiah 8:10, we can deduce that Messiah, or Emmanuel, will be born before the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. This person that's known as Emmanuel, or God with us, will have to come before 70 AD. That, it's a small prophecy, but in itself it's a big deal, because again, it disqualifies a lot of further messiahs in the history of mankind. And so people never think of it this way. But they should. From Isaiah 9:6 and 7, we can deduce that Messiah would be a king, that Messiah would be both God and man, and that Messiah will be born before the destruction of the temple in 70 AD as well. So I did not think that I would be doing all this in 1 hour tonight, so we're done a little early. Do you have any questions? Let me...